the role teachers play in lifting up the city's young Black males. That conversation is just ahead. Well, hope you had a nice weekend. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. Just ahead, we'll tell you about the effort to reclaim Jacksonville's young African-American men and the upcoming Urban Education Symposium. You can get on the line right now with your questions at 549-2937. Then later, UF Health opens up a brand new hospital on the city's north side. Plus, a thrilling Super Bowl finish last night. Culpepper will have a look back at the game. Plus, two local agency pros will rate the game's best and worst ads. Which ones were your favorite? All of that ahead. But first this morning, a major initiative looking at how the First Coast can better support its African-American boys and young men. The 7th Annual Urban Education Symposium, Reclaiming Young Black Males for Jacksonville's Future, is coming up this weekend. And the focus this year involves educators, teachers, what they're doing in the classroom. There's a lot to discuss and some progress to report. Symposium organizers Cleve Warren and Dr. Barbara Darby, president of FSCJ North, join us now in studio. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Melissa.
Great to have you in the studio. And right now, let us know your thoughts about the city's Urban Education Symposium. The title, Reclaiming Young Black Males for Jacksonville's Future. What are your questions and comments? 549-2937 is the number to join the show, 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us, and you can also weigh in on Facebook. Dr. Darby, let's begin with you. This year's event is focusing on who is teaching and leading our students in the classroom. As an educator, why did you decide that was important this year?
Because when we talk about achievement in the classroom, it is definitely a partnership. It is a partnership that is led by teachers. Students participate in that partnership, and so it is important to focus on the two components that ultimately will result in what we hope to be a positive outcome for our young Black males.
Cleve Warren, this symposium has been going on for 7 years now. You've been instrumental in this. Can you explain what the mission of this annual event is all about for those that might not have heard about it before?
Well, when you look through the program for this year, you'll note that the graduation rate for our county is improving, and that for African-American males as well. But there's still a huge gap between the performance of African-American males and the rest of the student population in our county. And that then continues then the mission to improve graduation rates and academic performance for African-American males to enhance their opportunities for success in our economy.
Now, at this event, you'll have Mayor Alvin Brown, Superintendent Dr. Nicolai Vitti. You're also going to hear from students. What do you anticipate that will be like as you welcome teachers? You also want to hear from the kids, right?
Yes. This will be the third year that we would have done a youth symposium in conjunction with the Urban Education Symposium on Saturday. The Friday event is the youth symposium, and they have shared some great things with us over the years that we have been able to learn from. So we look forward to hearing from them about what they perceive are the attributes of a great teacher.
And we'll go to your calls on this in just a moment at 549-2937. Getting that feedback is important, Dr. Darby, because, correct me if I'm wrong, there is data, isn't there, to show that teachers and students of color, especially young men, there are often communication issues.
Absolutely. In the classroom, of course, students learn in different ways, and we know through research that young Black males learn best when they have the opportunity to collaborate, work in groups, to use creativity in the learning process. And so it is important for teachers and students to both understand what the requirements are in the classroom in order to achieve the goal, and that is to be prepared for the workforce, to be prepared for higher education.
And life in general. And if you're just joining the program, right now we've got to look ahead to this weekend's 7th Annual Urban Education Symposium, Reclaiming Young Black Males for Jacksonville's Future. We want your calls. 549-2937. And Cleve Warren, the word reclaiming is important. Can you explain why that's in the title of this event?
Yes, I can. These young men, we've felt like, and our community, quite frankly, felt like they were being lost. Lost in our education system, lost in our judicial system, in need of an outreach effort. And so the Urban Education Symposium has been about trying to address their needs through one particular venue, and that's been about education. There are other things to be done in our community, and we obviously can't digest the entire elephant. But we have sought over these last 7 years to address in a very, very active way their needs as it relates to their educational needs.
And there's progress to report. Let's talk about some of the initiatives that you can brag about a little bit. For example, you were instrumental in the founding of an all-boys school for young black men in the city, Valor Academy. That opened in summer of 2014. How's that going?
Valor is going great. I can't take credit, however, for being founder of the idea and the notion. The idea actually came out of the symposium, a desire by the initial group of about 500 people for us to experiment with gender-based education in our community. As a matter of fact, the school board has an initiative of their own as well. But Dr. Darby and I and others very, very adamant about this initiative, and it came to fruition August of last year. We have about 150 boys there, and they are doing just great.
And Dr. Darby, there will be a similar school for girls coming this fall. Can you tell us about that?
That is our goal. Certainly, VASA is the opportunity for young women in our community, and we certainly believe that young girls require equal attention in terms of their academic progress. And if you look at the data, when we look at black males, black females, white males, and white females, there's definitely a gap in achievement for both black males and black females. And so we have to focus on both groups. And so our plan this coming year is to really address the girls as well.
Yes. And if you're just tuning in, how to close the achievement gap, as we speak with Cleve Warren and Dr. Barbara Darby about the upcoming Urban Education Symposium, Reclaiming the City's Young Black Males for Jacksonville's Future. What are your thoughts and comments about this positive effort and this initiative, which has made some progress in closing the achievement gap? We need your calls right now at 549-2937. Lyle in Jacksonville. Hi, Lyle. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. very complex issue, in my opinion. Black males, too many these days come from homes where there's no father. I think that's such a huge point, because the expectations are not set for them for what it takes to become a man. So when they get to the school, they're not prepared too many times to go ahead, you know, and be motivated and learn. So what it means then is that whomever that instructor is, or those instructors are, have to really take a keen interest in that child and be able to identify with the child, and the child needs to be able to identify with the teacher and the environment that they're in. And so what's happening is, when these children leave home, they're leaving in such a state of mind whereby when they come to school, sometimes people are alienated by them because of the mindset they're coming with. So teachers don't all the time take liking to these children, or they don't have a personal interest because they feel somewhat threatened or alienated by the presence of these people, these young black men. So it's a very vicious cycle, and it's a large problem. And of course, you know, we can talk about it for days and weeks and months. But it has to start with, you know, it needs to start at home, but, you know, no one can really do anything about that directly anyway. But if there's no solution at home, then at least at the school, there has to be a reckoning. The teachers have to recognize that, okay, we're dealing with a certain type of mentality, and we have to really embrace the person. And that person has to feel embraced and accepted, and to have a chance at being motivated to learn.
And that's Lyle in Jacksonville. Excellent, Lyle. Thanks for those thoughts. Cleve Warren, what do you think about that caller's comments?
Well, I think he's on point with his comments. We recognize that these young men we have in particular at Valor, that they're kids. And they come to school each day with a different menu in their mail, in their lunchboxes, if you will, that have to be addressed. Our effort is to ensure that that what they get is indeed nurturing, nourishment for their souls, nourishment for them academically, nourishment for them culturally. So I would agree with him. There is a need to address the whole child, and we are attempting to do that with the resources that we have, recognizing that they come to school every day with something different in their lunchboxes.
Yeah, and Dr. Darby, when he talks about teachers having to grapple with kids that are coming from homes that aren't always an ideal two-parent family, as an educator, what are your thoughts about how to address that issue?
I do think we have to be mindful of the fact that we cannot change everything that surrounds these young men. But we certainly can strive to do the best with them while we have them in the space where they are. And so the nurturing, the understanding where they come from are very important. And the teacher is the leader in the classroom. And so certainly based on education, based on experience and expertise, the teachers then need to adapt a mentality, if you will, that I am the professional, I am the knowledgeable person, and here is what I know I need to do to support these young men to overcome the circumstances they come from through education.
549-2937 to join the show. Ken in Jacksonville. Hi, Ken. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you very much. Yeah, great. A couple things real quick. Number one, it seems to me that these all-black schools are state-sponsored segregation. And number two, I would say more on the lines of rather than having all-black schools, how about let's have schools for poor children from single-parent homes, because I'm sure the statistics would show that in single white homes where there's no father in the home, that the graduation rates according to income are probably just as low. And there's children just as much in need. So I think we need to make it less about coddling one group as taking care of our children as a whole from lower income homes and homes for single parents. Thank you.
That's Ken in Jacksonville. Cleve Warren, the last time you were on the show, we got some calls about this aspect of Valor Academy. Let's talk about the rationale behind this school. And there was a model, I believe, in Chicago, a really successful school up there. What about his comments?
Well, I think his comments are severely misplaced, quite frankly. Valor is not an all-black school. It's an all-boys school. And in fact, the population is a rather diverse population. Based on where it is, the makeup of the school is largely African-American boys. And that's what we hoped, is that we would attract those young men to a place like Valor. So we don't make excuses for it.
Nick in Ponte Vedra. Go ahead, Nick.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Great, thanks. Go ahead.
My point is without a lot of parental involvement, I don't really care what the schools do. They cannot succeed like they need to succeed. Maybe they succeed 10-20% of the time. They will fail without a parent, single parent, two parents, doesn't really matter, without a parent sitting down with them and doing homework, making sure they get tutoring, keeping them off the streets. No matter what you think, the government cannot succeed at it. It cannot succeed in almost anything. In particular, something as difficult as being a parent, which I know because I'm a parent. So the government could only succeed to a small extent. It is really about parents, and that's the emphasis needs to be. By the way, an interesting study just came out in one neighborhood, in two neighborhoods in New York, one poor, one not poor. One had 0% unmarried pregnancies. The other one had 60% unmarried pregnancies. And the grades followed with that. So you got to focus on something other than the government and the money that the government's going to spend, because if you don't, you can't succeed enough. You can succeed on the edges, but you really cannot succeed enough to solve the horrible problems that the Black community is suffering with right now. That's my opinion.
That's Nick and Pontevedra. Now, let me ask you both. Nicolae Vidi, the Duval superintendent, this is a separate effort from what we're here to talk about today, but he has begun a parent academy trying to provide more parental support and outreach. At this symposium, there's going to be a parent and guardians panel, right? What are your thoughts about callers that keep bringing this issue up, that are skeptical of how we can all collectively have an impact if parents at home aren't doing their part?
Parental involvement, no one will argue with its importance, and we would be the last ones to do that. However, absent parental involvement, then these young people still need support to achieve and to become successful in this society. I would say that in my generation, I know quite a few individuals, not just a few, but many, who came from circumstances that some people would consider less than ideal, but they are extremely successful. And my question would be, who helped them? The village helped them. The village was the community, neighbors, and
teachers
and other interested persons who said, I am responsible for this young person, and I'm going to do what I can to help them.
Cleve.
And Melissa, we've had a huge outpouring at Valor, as an example, from groups like the 100 Black Men or the Continental Societies, from sororities, from fraternities, just people in the community, from churches who have just shown their great interest in helping, recognizing that there's a need for surrogate representation if we're going to make some impact here and influence these young men in a positive way, and young ladies when we have them, that it is a village. It takes a village to be successful in this effort.
549-2937. Lots of calls coming into the show this Monday. Lawrence in Jacksonville. Hi, Lawrence. Go ahead. Okay, Lawrence. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. I was thinking about Ferguson and the difficulty that we've experienced across this country with law enforcement. And one of the things that seems to have a common thread was that they need to have more police officers that looked like the community that they serve. And I think that the school should do no less. I don't hear the initiative to try and recruit more Black teachers to teach these young Black boys, because there has to be a synergy and a relationship that goes beyond just reading, writing, and arithmetic. And I think the more Black teachers being recruited, and we need to find a way to encourage more Black people to become teachers. That's number one. Number two, we need to have a program to teach Black history, not just to Black students, but to all the students, so there can be a recognition of our contributions, Black people's contribution to this society and societies across this world historically. And I think that would go a long way in changing what I consider one of the main problems with Black children, and that's an inferiority complex created by a society that devalues them. Thirdly, uniforms. One of the biggest problems with learning in the inner city especially is behavior problems in the school. And one of the things that drives the behavior problems is competition with the attire one might wear.
Okay, Lawrence. I hear you. Uniforms and all the other points. Sorry to cut you off. It's just that lots of folks are now waiting to speak as well. Let me get your reaction to Lawrence's comments. Cleve.
Well, I hear him. I read him loud and clear.
Right.
They are common problems, and what we seek to do with these young men is to provide them with great teaching. I'm indifferent about what complexion that teacher is, as long as it's a great teacher.
It's a good teacher. What about the uniform idea? Don't they wear uniforms at Valor?
They wear uniforms at Valor, and they wear them proudly.
Dr. Darby.
I would add that at our original symposium in 2009, one of the 11 initiatives that came out of that symposium was to recruit African-American male teachers, very reason this gentleman mentioned. And so that's one of the things that we hope that we have lifted to a higher level of awareness through the six symposia. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right.
Because we want more individuals to recognize the need and make a decision to go that way.
Lindsay in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Lindsay.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask about, in particular with Valor, the issue of leadership and the setting of reasonable, achievable expectations, as well as the idea of personal responsibility. And in helping those students, I think it relates to the issue of self-confidence and a better self-image.
Lindsay, thanks for the call.
Well, nothing about school should be about spoon-feeding. As my grandmother would say, anything worth having is worth working for. And we require the young men at Valor to work hard for academic achievement as well as anything else.
The bar's pretty high.
It is very high.
Yeah. Rick in Riverside. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to agree with an earlier caller who said that the problems of hopelessness, underachievement, criminality, sorts of things are not exclusive to black males, but they're crystallized in that population because that population represents they're overrepresented in the poor and the downtrodden, if you will. I think that if you went to another part of the country where Hispanics or American Indians represented that group, you'd see exactly the same problems. And the core of the problem is that the energy and the thrust of the society, both consciously and unconsciously, is on seeing that the well-to-do do well. And with, the belief that everyone else will do well then. The Koch brothers recently announced that they'll spend $1 billion to elect a president and congressman. There's no way that the political class can have their allegiance to the poor and the hopeless when they need that kind of money, and it's not going to come from the poor and the hopeless. It's not to say that a grassroots movement and leadership from the bottom can't happen, but it means that every single obstacle that can be put in the place, in the face of some kind of change from the bottom, will be there and probably will not occur. In fact, I think that there are parts of our society that will actively defeat that sort of thing because they fear a coalition of the poor and the middle class, a la FDR.
And that's Rick in Riverside. Rick, thanks for the call. So, the politics of what you're doing. Either one of you.
Never mind the politics.
Not going there today?
Well, I would say never mind the politics.
Not germane to what you're doing?
Correct. I mean, and it's an important issue to be recognized for sure that there will be obstacles, particularly political obstacles. But on the other hand, nothing about what we do in the society can be done in order of. They have to be done simultaneously. I said earlier that this is a fairly large elephant and we can't digest in terms of all of the needs for African-American males and African-American children. But this issue is one about education. We're focused here. What it also says, and I would agree with the speaker, the caller, that there is much to be done, so there is much for all of us to do.
And that leads me to tweets coming into the show. Several have asked, what can we do to help? How can people get involved?
Well, first of all, I would say please attend the symposium on Saturday. It begins at 8:30 with registration. The program begins at 9. We will provide at that time opportunity for individuals to indicate where they might want to lend their expertise, their talent, and their time. And hopefully we will be able to connect them with opportunities both at Valor or within the public school district. But there is much work to be done and lots of hands are needed. I would say that in response to the last caller, I would say that Margaret Mead's thoughts that their change only occurs when a few thoughtful people come together to bring that change about. It's real. And so whatever the political ear might be or the economic ear might be, it still requires that when we have issues such as the one we're talking about today, that thoughtful people come around the table to make a difference.
Well, we appreciate your thoughts this morning, both of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Cleve Warren joining us and Dr. Barbara Darby, President FSCJ North. And again, for those who are interested, mark your calendar for Saturday's 7th Annual Urban Education Symposium, Reclaiming Young Black Males for Jacksonville's Future. Bright and early Saturday morning, kicking off at 8:30 a.m. at the Downtown Main Library, MC Daryl Willey, appearances by Mayor Alvin Brown, Superintendent Nicolai Vitti, and many more. Come on out and be part of it. Well, later, one of the most exciting Super Bowl finishes that many can remember, Cole Pepper will have some thoughts on the game. Plus, don't miss it as we rate the Super Bowl ads. That's later. But up next, UF Health opens a new hospital, a new facility on the city's north side. We'll tell you all about it right after this.
Education coverage on First Coast Connect is made possible in part by a grant from the Chartrand Foundation.
A Middle Passage Remembrance Ceremony and Historic Marker Unveiling will be held Saturday, February 7th in St. Augustine. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Ann Chin, who is leading the commemoration of African slaves. We'll discuss Sunny South Farms in DeSoto County and visit the Turnbull Plantation exhibit at the New Smyrna Museum. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air...
You got some sort of savior complex?
I just want to get the bad guys, but if I can't see them, I can't shoot them.
Like all these guys, they know your name. They feel invincible with you up there.
We talk with Bradley Cooper about his new film, American Sniper, about Navy SEAL Chris Kyle, and the controversy surrounding the movie. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Chances are, you remember where you were when prosecutors released the verdicts about Michael Brown and Eric Gardner. When grand juries cleared police of wrongdoing in their deaths, the nation responded with protests, finger-pointing, and questions. I'm State of the Reunion host Al Letson. Join WJCT for an open and honest discussion that brings issues of race and justice to the forefront with the hopes of understanding and change. Race in the River City, February 12th at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
All your favorite oldies tonight at 10 on Route 66, only on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Lots of fanfare about the city's newest medical facility, UF Health North, opening up in a couple of weeks on Jacksonville's north side, with state-of-the-art technology, a new birthing center, and much more. This is going to serve quite a few patients on the northern end of town. We've got a preview right now as we welcome Cindy Williams, nurse midwife and director of UF Health North's birth center. Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to see you. And of course, UF Health North has everything in the world. It's got all kinds of new technology. There will be nearly 100 patient beds and a big grand opening coming up in a couple of weeks. This facility up near the airport in the River City Marketplace area.
Yes.
So people on the north side have wanted this for years. It's
yes.
exciting to see it opening. And in particular, you're excited about the birth center. Can you tell us what new moms can look forward to?
Yes. So this is something that's kind of new to the area and kind of cutting edge. I think there's a couple of places in the country that have like a hospital affiliated birth center. So this is something where it's in a medical office building. There will be a hospital built there, you know, in the next couple of years. But for now, there's the ER, surgical suites, lots of specialty offices. And then in this building is a freestanding birth center. So that's due to open March 2nd. I think the first two floors will open February 16th.
But. And this is not your typical birth center. This is pretty exciting. Moms will be able to look at all kinds of options, natural births, heated tubs to give birth in, heated whirlpool
yes.
tubs. Is that right?
Yes. So we have kind of set it up to be like a home or spa setting where you're relaxed. And that's one of the benefits is that you don't have to go into a hospital, which for some people that seems kind of scary and they don't feel like they're sick. They do not want to go and have just the normal routine medical interventions unless they need them. So this is a place where they would have their prenatal care, have been through a risk assessment that shows that they are low risk and healthy, and we expect them to have a normal pregnancy and birth, and then we will admit them to that same area into, there's a couple of bedrooms that have heated whirlpool tubs, and so they would be admitted there for labor and postpartum.
And so this is exciting because in the past, expectant moms that wanted to use the expertise of a nurse midwife such as yourself and give birth at home in a really low-key, natural setting, not a hospital setting, now they can do it at this center. This is not at all like what you think of, I think, when you think of the delivery room. This is a completely different thing.
So it is kind of a balance. There are a couple of other birth centers in town, and there is a large population in the Jacksonville area who like this kind of natural, organic healthcare and want to avoid medications when possible and medical interventions when possible. And this is kind of an in-between, sort of to bridge the hospital in that setting for people who are unsure about that and are looking for something a little bit different. This will be where you come. Again, there is not epidural there. I have had some patients specifically ask that. So it is for natural kind of unmedicated births, but we have the backing of the hospital and
in
physicians,
case you need it.
Right? So
sure.
So it's kind of, that's where we get the difference and the balance is that it's affiliated with the OBGYN department at UF Health, which we're pretty excited about.
Absolutely. And with this home-like setting, when a woman comes in and she's in labor, here's some of the differences. She can walk all around, eat and drink whatever she wants, wear her own clothes. I like that. Mm-hmm. Don't have to put on the hospital gown.
Right.
She can use the tub and shower at any time during labor and birth. Just some of the differences.
Right. And women like those things. The people who are concerned that, especially first-time moms, say, well, I really don't know what to expect, and maybe I am going to need an epidural. Really, a lot of those things help women take control, which also helps manage the pain or the unknown. A lot of times it's fear that causes a lot of it. And so when you're in a setting that you're familiar and with people that you're familiar with and you're kind of choosing and in control actually helps the whole process and helps it to go as it's supposed to instead right. of when you're at the hospital and things kind of make you nervous and then sort of changes everything.
Sure. And I would think, too, is this a first of its kind for Jacksonville? Moms having the option of giving having a water birth with the hospital-like setting in the background?
Yes, this would be the first birth center like this in the area. And as I said, the collaboration is kind of unique even around the country. There's just a couple of places like this where you have the option with the backup facility, backup physicians. So there will be an ambulance on site if there were emergencies that would be connected to the UF Health facility. And so we like that kind of balance, too.
I'm sure there's a lot of anticipation.
We're getting really excited. We've had probably about 200 patients email, you know, asking for information and wanting to transfer, and we've already been taking care of some of those patients, so we hope to be open for deliveries March 2nd as well. We think we'll have some people delivering right away when we open.
Very exciting. It's the new birthing center at UF Health's new Northside Medical Facility. Patient beds coming in the second phase. She's Cindy Williams, certified nurse midwife and director of the birth center. Kudos, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're back in a moment with a look at the Super Bowl finish, but also the ads. Which ones did you like? That's right after this.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet...
And who doesn't?
We're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
Looking for fresh music? Join us weeknights at 7 for After Hours. You'll hear everything from jazz to electronica. Only on 89.9 FM After Hours. Your community, your world, your music.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo, Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly... We're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, ISIS and other extremist groups have received tens of millions of dollars in ransom for hostages. The U.S. has a policy of not paying for release of captured Americans, rethinking hostage policies.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the Budweiser puppy did last night what the Seattle Seahawks couldn't. It won back-to-back Super Bowls. Anheuser-Busch's spot during the game last night topped a lot of viewer polls as one of the best of the night, but which one was your favorite? Right now, we are rating the Super Bowl ads with two local pros as we welcome Pat McKinney, Chief Creative Officer, and Jeremy Nettles, Vice President of Social Media, both with Jacksonville's Dalton Agency. Hi, guys. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Hi, how you doing?
Great to see you both. People watch this game, of course, just as much for the halftime show and the ads as they do for the game. As you break down the ads, Pat, let's begin with you. This is interesting. You gave me some numbers. Back in 1967, the cost of a 30-second spot during the game was about $300,000. Now it's $10 million. Is it really worth the money?
Well, the commercials themselves are worth $4.5 million.
Okay.
But they're saying the worth is $10
million. Oh, I see.
Which
the exposure that you get after the game, too.
Absolutely. With the amount of eyeballs that are seen, live viewership. Then you have the online. And then, like what we're doing right now, which is continually talking about it.
So what topped your list last night?
For me, it was Doritos, and I think it was because it's nostalgic for me. You know,
sure.
You go back to the Brady Bunch, and you've got Danny Trejo that's playing Marsha. I mean, it was classic.
Let's listen to that one, the one that referenced the Brady Bunch. Pretty funny. Take a listen.
Marsha, what happened?
Peter hit me in the nose with a football. I can't go to the dance like this.
Well, I'm sure it was an accident, sweetheart.
An eye for an eye. That's what Dad always says.
I never said that, honey.
Shut up! Time to teach Peter a lesson.
Marsha, eat a Snickers.
Why?
You get a little hostile when you're hungry. Better? Better.
Marsha, Marsha, Marsha.
Jan, this isn't about you.
It never is!
Jeremy Nettles, how did that one do on social media?
That one did really well. As far as the humor angle goes, that was probably the top of the mark online.
Really? And as Pat said, the value of these ads plays out before the game, during the game, and then after the game.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, before the game, I mean, these ads already get pre-released on YouTube. I mean, the Mercedes-Benz ad had 5 million views before it even went to air on YouTube. So, I mean, there's a long lifespan for these ads when they air during the Super Bowl.
A few more data points from the Dalton Agency. 15 new advertisers for the big game. 11 were food and beverage. 8 were automotive related. The Dodge ad, Pat, you wanted to mention that one. Let's listen to that one for a minute.
I'm 100 years old, and I want to tell the world what I have learned.
Live for now, because life is good. You make it good.
You will learn not to cheat.
There are miracles all around you.
Stay young.
Always tell the truth.
Keep your eyes open and sometimes your mouth shut.
Don't complain.
Tell it like it is.
Don't bitch.
Hesitate and you lose.
Put the pedal to the metal.
Live fast.
And never, ever forget where you came from.
And that was Dodge with a bunch of centenarians talking about what they've learned living 100 years. Why did that one stand out for you?
It's funny because it came out, you know, a lot of the ads were very serious. So that when you're starting to listen to this, you hear some of this wisdom, and then it kind of goes into something that's very clever. It really, started resonating with the brand itself. So
yeah, so that's a touchdown in the ad world, isn't it?
I thought it was definitely a win for Dodge.
Now, let me ask you, Jeremy, as Pat said, a lot of these ads were pretty serious, not as jokey as what we've been used to.
Yeah, and that definitely reflected in some of the conversation on Twitter during the game. I think people were almost a little bit bummed out to a certain extent. I think they wanted more fun, more, you know, comedy and less of the really serious overtones in a lot of the ads.
And you call this dadvertising?
Yes. Well, there was some dadvertising last night for sure.
Explain what that means.
Well, we noticed last night that there was a lot of social issues that were getting touched upon, and Dad seemed to make the list on a lot of those. You had Dove, Nissan, Camry had a spot, so Dad kind of made an appearance for sure.
Interesting. And it's also interesting, 62% of people who watch the Super Bowl will rewatch the ads later, maybe on YouTube or somewhere else, showing the value on social.
Yeah, that's where that extra $10 million value comes from that NBC was toting around this year, is from that extra life that they get after the game.
And last but not least, who would you say flopped last night in terms of their ad, Pat?
No, it was Nationwide, which is amazing.
Nationwide.
They ended up having two pretty decent commercials, nice spots, and then they had this big old downer. And if you're looking at what's actually trending in the negative, it is pretty much leading the charge. It's almost as much as the positive for Always, which I think was a really good commercial.
Yeah, that was the one about running and throwing like a girl.
Yeah, like a girl, which is really good.
That was also great. Well, it's so fascinating to speak with you both. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us about this aspect of the big game.
Sure.
Thank you.
And we were joined by Pat McKinney, Chief Creative Officer, and Jeremy Nettles. He's Vice President of Social Media with Jacksonville's Dalton Agency. And finally, this hour, it was one of the more exciting finishes in Super Bowl history.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper breaks down last night's game as the Patriots hung on to beat the Seahawks. Hey, Cole, it started off kind of boring, but then things really got exciting later on.
You know, sometimes the most memorable and exciting thing that happens in the evening is a commercial or the halftime show. I think actually this time, while there were plenty of things to talk about commercials and halftime show-wise, when the game comes down to the wire like this, this is a real talk. This is a memorable finish for sure. Patriots held on to beat the Seahawks 28-24. Finish was just amazing. First, Tom Brady leads the Patriots from 10 points down to score the go-ahead touchdown with just over 2 minutes to play. Then the Seahawks get into scoring position when Jerome Kearse catches a ball that was tipped, then bounced off his leg while he was laying on the ground, and you thought, well, this is destined to be then. Here we are. The Seahawks are at the 5-yard line with a couple of timeouts remaining, about 30 seconds to play. Mm-hmm. On first down, they hand the ball off to their beast mode running back, Marshawn Lynch, who powers for 4 yards. They're at the 1-yard line. Everybody on the planet is saying, Here comes Marshawn Lynch. Will the Patriots actually mention on the broadcast with Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth, are they just going to let him score so they'll have more time? But no, instead, inexplicably, the Seahawks decide to throw the football.
I thought you were going to say inconceivable.
Inconceivable. I don't think that thing means what you think it means.
Exactly.
So, so they throw the ball, and it's intercepted by rookie Malcolm Butler, who'd never had an interception before as a pro this year. And the Patriots get the victory, their fourth Super Bowl title in the last 14 years, and it gives some real historic precedent, I think, here to Tom Brady. Fourth ring for him, tying Joe Montana and Terry Bradshaw, and he and Montana now are the only players ever to have three Super Bowl MVPs.
Right, and meanwhile, this Deflategate investigation technically continues. What do you think about that?
I don't think anything's going to come of it. I think the NFL is going to look at these TV ratings. Almost half the country watched this game. Highest-rated Super Bowl ever. Patriots win. Everything's fine. There's nothing to see here. Please move along. I think that's sort of going to be the way that the NFL approaches this in the offseason.
And the Seahawks, they don't win the brass ring, but you think they're still in pretty good shape for next year?
They have a young quarterback. They're young nucleus on both sides of the ball. One of the questions is whether there'll be a hangover from this loss. Sometimes you lose in this way, you never bounce back. For instance, the Titans, remember they lost when they couldn't get the last final yard to tie the game against the Rams. They never really challenged for the Super Bowl after that, after the 99 season. So we'll see if the Seahawks can shake it off next year.
Sure. Meanwhile, lots of excitement here in town as the football season ends out and the Armada gear up for their first match at Everbank Field Saturday.
Yep, against the Philadelphia Union of the MLS. It won't be the first taste of Major League Soccer competition for the Armada, who will play in the North American Soccer League. Yesterday, the Armada played a scrimmage with New York City FC, the MLS expansion team owned by the same company who owns the defending champions of the English Premier League, Manchester City. And Thursday, they'll scrimmage with the New York Red Bulls in Orlando. But Saturday will be a full-fledged game. And Armada FC president Steve Livingstone says that the past couple of weeks have been a real whirlwind of activity for the club.
Oh, it's been really exciting, hectic, busy. We're just, obviously we're on the final push now this week into the match and trying to put as many people in the stadium as possible for what is a historic inaugural match for us. So it's been a real enjoyable time to work in the build up to this match as well. So we're really excited about it. We've got some nice things happening on Saturday, and we're really looking forward to it.
What's the atmosphere going to be like? What's the experience going to be like for fans and folks coming to the match on Saturday?
Well, Everbank feels a great place to run an event, and I think the people that come along to watch us, our fans, our season ticket owners, and anybody that's just interested, are really going to enjoy themselves. It's going to be a little bit different. You know, soccer's a little bit more rowdy. Our fans are going to be noisy throughout the match. Our Section 904, I think, are going to keep everybody entertained with their chants and their songs and their drums. And the match will be preceded by a three-hour pre-game party. Entertainment in the South Plaza that will include displays from the military. We'll have some musical acts there. And then we move inside the stadium, and the teams will come out and entertain us. And we've got a halftime show that's going to be just awesome, you know, fireworks and laser light show, just to really set us off on our way and help us launch in style.
You want to make a big impression, and you also have a chance in terms of on the pitch playing against an MLS side who have been playing together for a long time, have some established stars, some former U.S. men's national team players as well. So it's going to be a good test of soccer.
It's a great way to start off, you know, and I think if we want any kind of idea on where we where we're ranking and where we're sitting in terms of quality of play, it's a great way to start. I know Dario Sala, our coaches, the team are really looking forward to getting out there and taking on the Union. They're a quality team. I think it's going to be an entertaining match. They've already said they want to come and play and win the match. So, we're not only playing for the Armada, we're playing for the whole city of Jacksonville, who we represent, and also our league, the North American Soccer League.
What does it tell us about soccer in Jacksonville and soccer in the country? What will we learn about that, if anything, on Saturday?
Well, you know, we're expecting a good crowd, so I think it says that the game is developing, is maturing. I think our crowd will be made up with people that know soccer and have been involved in soccer for a long time. whether it be from the youth teams or just soccer fans in general. But I think we'll also see a new crowd there as well. Folks that are coming out maybe to watch a professional soccer game for the first time. And it does speak volumes for how far the game has come, where you can, you know, fill one side, hopefully, of our bank field for a soccer match.
And are there still tickets available?
Absolutely. Give us a call at the Armada Ticket Office, 1-844-2-ARMADA, or visit our website, or go to Ticketmaster and buy your tickets there. Seats are selling fast, and it's going to be a great event. Great event not only for soccer, for the Armada, but I think for the city of Jacksonville as well. And we want the whole community to come out, show their support, back the team.
Armada FC President Steve Livingstone, thank you.
Thank you, Cole.
In fact, I'm hearing over 7,000 tickets have been sold so far.
Oh, that's
great. Expect a couple thousand more this week than the famous Jacksonville walk-up.
Of course.
Could be looking at over 10,000 for the match. A 5:30 kickoff at Everbank Field on Saturday.
And you can always catch Cole calling the game on TV, too, on the CW. Cole, have fun, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The theme of the show, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. And make sure to catch our daily podcasts. They are now up on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, ISIS and other extremist groups have received tens of millions of dollars in ransom for hostages. The U.S.'s policy is not to pay for the release of captured Americans. Rethinking hostage policies, that's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the Florida TPO.